Hey everybody, and welcome to Season 2 of No Root, No Fruit, A History of Folk Roots and Americana Music, One Record at a Time. Season 2 was made possible by the generous support of almost 100 listeners who were able and kind enough to donate to a successful Kickstarter campaign. If you like what you hear, check out the transcripts and links for each episode at norootnofruit.com. While there, you can also make a direct donation to keep the podcast coming. You may also choose to become a sustaining contributor through my Patreon page. All those options, including access to the episodes in Season 1, are all at norootnofruit.com. Now let's get this show started. What follows are some snippets from two interviews. The first you'll hear will be Joseph Campbell speaking to Bill Moyers in 1988. The other voice you'll hear will be Dave Carter from an interview he did with me in the year 2000. First, Joseph Campbell talking about the concept of following your bliss.
I came to this idea of bliss because in Sanskrit, which is the great spiritual language of the world, and they know all about it and have known about it for a long time, the transcendent is transcendent. But there are three terms that bring you to the brink. You might say the jumping off place to the ocean. And the three terms are Sat, Chit, Ananda. And Sat, the word Sat, means being. Chit means full consciousness. And Ananda means rapture. So I thought, I don't know whether my consciousness is full consciousness or not. I don't know whether my being is proper being or not. But I do know where my rapture is. So let me hang on to rapture. And that'll bring me both being and full consciousness, and it works.
Well, you know, I knew when I was 6 years old, I knew I wanted to be a songwriter. And I started working at writing poetry and music. It took me a long time. I think I was in my early teens when I actually started to assemble these into something that sounded like a song you'd want to listen to. I come from a family that's mostly mathematicians and very religious types, and really, really felt like the occupation of musician was one or two rungs beneath that of burglar. And so there was a great deal of pressure on me my whole life to find something else to do, even though I didn't really want to do anything else.
A poet is simply one who's made a profession and a lifestyle of being in touch with that.
Having been influenced by Joseph Campbell, I decided I would make a journey to Nashville. I felt that I had to do this without a map, and I just set out from Portland, Oregon, in the general direction of Nashville. I mean, I was out alone in the desert, and oh man, I just had these great experiences. I woke up one morning, I'd camped out someplace in the dark, and I woke up and I was right by these ancient Anasazi ruins, and then after a while I went to this ghost town. I picked this cowboy up hitchhiking, his horse had you know, gone down in the desert somewhere, and all he had on him was a saddle and a rifle. And it's the first and probably last time I ever picked anybody up hitchhiking that was carrying a firearm, but it seemed like the natural thing to do. Then anyhow, I got out to Nashville, and with a quivering voice and quivering fingers, I played a couple of the songs I'd written at an open mic at Douglas Corner, which is a very hip hangout for great songwriters. I was really, really scared, but got great acceptance from them and met a bunch of people that night that encouraged me to keep going.
If you do follow your bliss, you put yourself on a kind of track that has been there all the while waiting for you. And the life that you ought to be living is the one you're living somehow. And when you can see it, you begin to deal with people who are in the field of your bliss, and they open doors to you. I say follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be.
The waters of eternal life?
Right there.
Where?
Wherever you are. if you're following your bliss. I mean, you're having that joy, that refreshment, that life all the time.
Dave Carter was born on August 13, 1952, and died suddenly from a heart attack 1 month before his 50th birthday. Dave, along with his partner Tracy Grammer, had released 3 studio recordings and were in high demand to play the best festivals and concert stages all over North America. They met and started playing together just 5 years before. I have a clear memory of being at the Folk Alliance Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico in February of 1999. I was crossing the street at a busy intersection when I ran into my friend Andrew Calhoun. Now, you may remember Andrew as a guest on the episode about John Prine. As a brilliant songwriter himself and as the president of Waterbug Records, Andrew comes in contact with lots and lots and lots of singer-songwriters. When he recommends something, I pay attention. That day, he handed me a copy of the CD When I Go by Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer and just gave me a look. Back in my hotel room, I remember playing the first and title track 5 times before moving on to the rest. Andrew was right. It was astonishing. Dave Carter came on the scene later than most, and he stuck around for shorter than most, but his impact as a writer continues to influence and inspire 35 years after he started winning song contests and getting his music out to a larger audience. I had folks lining up to talk about When I Go for this podcast, but the one I asked was in many ways responsible for the record being born. Tracy Grammer met Dave Carter just 2 years prior to the recording of the album.
I met Dave Carter in 1996. I had just moved to Portland from Berkeley, California. I had moved up there to be with my boyfriend, Dave, also named Dave. We call him Dave number 2 in a series of 3. And Dave number 2 was also a songwriter, brilliant songwriter, and I sang along with him. And we had a little band called Juicy, and it was kind of like pop music, you know, it was a little quirky, influenced by like maybe Crowded House and the Beatles and that sort of thing. Anyway, Dave number 2 had moved up to Portland. I followed. It was January, and he said, let's go do this songwriter showcase for the Portland Songwriters Association. So he put our names in the hat. We showed up. We were number 6 on the list. It was so nerve-wracking. I was there with my violin singing along with Dave number 2, and just a room full of people, crowded, noisy, you know, people smoking out back because that's what you did. Nobody really listening, you know. It's like there'd be some faint applause afterwards and people would go back to drinking their beer. You know, what do you expect on a Tuesday night, right? And then this cowboy comes into the room, you know, this tall guy with a cowboy hat and a Merle Haggard t-shirt and like jean jacket, end of the trail belt buckle. I mean, he's just cowboy head to toe down to the boots. And he's carrying this giant guitar. And in his other arm, he's got this briefcase with just papers poking out, you know. And he starts making his way through the crowd. And this is toward the end of the night. And everybody starts to get quiet. And I'm like, well, who's this guy? You know, who's the cowboy coming in? And he takes a seat up at the front of the stage because he's the last performer. And starts taking out his guitar, and next to him is this girl, and her name is Susan Martin. She's got a jumper on and clumpy shoes and little tights and long brown hair, and she's gonna be singing along with him. She's also got a guitar. And so he takes off his hat and he starts to play the first song, which is a song called Gunmetal Eyes, a song about a young Native American man standing up for the land against big business.
His mama was a Cherokee princess, or so it was said. And his daddy was a Seminole rebel with a price on his head.
And the first words out of his mouth were, his mama was a Cherokee princess, or so it was said. And I perked up because I was just up from Berkeley, where I had gotten my degree in English literature with a focus on Native American women's literature. And so I was like, what? Cherokee princess? What? This is exciting. And his daddy was a Seminole rebel with a price on his head. And I heard Seminole rebel and I thought, oh my gosh, You know, I was born in Florida and it's all about the Seminoles, you know, down there. And I even had a sweatshirt with a big old Seminole on it. And I was like, how does he know me? You know? And so I tuned into this performer and to this duo, and to the exclusion of everyone else in the room, which had, by the way, gotten pin drop quiet. I mean, everybody was leaning in. Dave number two looked at me and he saw that I was just completely rapt. And he said, oh, you're really going to love this guy. He sounds just like Lyle Lovett. I was like, okay, we'll see about that.
Run with the wolf, fly like a dove, mother below, father above, wait with the earth, sing to the sky, in the steel of your gun that lies, lay in the steel of your gun that lies.
Dave Carter sings his songs, Susan Martin singing along. All I'm thinking is, how can I get her job? You know, like, she's got the best job in the world. How does a person get to do that? You know, I don't know. I don't get the answer to it. By the time he's done, I'm completely moved. I want to go home and play my guitar. I'm so inspired. And so the crowd is sort of shuffling out the doors, the swinging doors of the Buffalo Gap. And Dave Carter's Jumbo Taylor guitar case just happens to tap my violin case as we're both moving toward the door. And it's almost like you could hear it. I mean, in retrospect, you could hear the universal ding happening right there. And that was the moment. And he looked down and he said, oh, you've got a violin there. And I said, yeah. And he says, do you want to be in my band? And I was like, wait a minute. You know, my internal dialogue just went crazy right then, because I was like, he hasn't heard me play. I don't know this guy from Adam. But then my mouth just goes, yes, yes, I do. And so he hands me his card and says, you know, to give him a call. And that was how I met him. It was so crazy. I remember the first rehearsal. It was with the band. It was a five-piece band, and Susan Martin was the singer, and I was the violin player. Dave brought some sheet music, and I played the solo for Kate and the Ghost of Lost Love, which he'd never actually heard on a violin. It was beautiful. And we had this band for a period of a couple years, about a year and a half. And then there was this gig, a backyard party. No one else could attend the gig except for me. And so he said, do you want to maybe try singing along with some of the parts? You know, I had done like some third part and fourth part harmonies, but I'd never sung just with Dave, just the two of us. And so we got together for a rehearsal to see what kind of music we could make just as a duo. And it was instantaneous. We realized right away that the band was toast. Like, we're just like, they're all busy. We're here. This sounds phenomenal. Let's go. You know, and so as it happened, you know, everybody did get busy. Susan got married. These guys got busy with work, whatever. Everyone went on to different things. And we just made a run for it.
Sweet love is a Kate, star that will not your shine. Gate. Here I stand of your return. Threadbare. In cups in of my hair, how I need those I have
learned. So that's how they met. I was wondering how they got the songs out there. What led to the recording of When I Go? Well, Tracy had the answers.
But I got the wild idea to send in a couple of songs to Kerrville on a tape. Dave didn't know I had done it. He wasn't going to do it. But I knew how much Texas meant to him. You know, that's where he was from. And so I thought if he, you know, and he just talked about the legendary Texas songwriters, I'm like, well, maybe you're one of them, you know? So I sent his tape to Kerrville, and he was so surprised to be named as a finalist. He was like, who did this? How did this happen? And I just raised my little hand and said, guilty. And so we went. We had met Buddy Monlock and Carol Elliott. And they set up a tent for us at Kerrville so that we didn't have to bring all that gear from Oregon. And we showed up on site and we did what we did and we met everybody and did the campfires. And Dave was one of the six winners at Kerrville. And there you go. That's, you know, That's how it all began. There is a funny story about Kerrville, actually. While we were waiting to get the results of the contest, Dave was sitting in the dirt, and all of a sudden, he started having sensations in his pants, like, and he didn't really know what was happening. And he got up and he realized that fire ants had crawled into his pants, and they were biting him in his nether regions as his name was being called to the stage. And so he's standing on stage, and you see him in the pictures just grinning, you know, and he's so happy. He's up there with Betty Elders and some other people, and but know that he was being bitten to smithereens. And everybody says, where's your record? Where's your record? Where's your record? And the only record he has is the solo record that he made a few years prior called Snake Handling Man, which is now out of print. He keeps telling everyone, oh, but I gotta make a recording with Tracy. You gotta hear Tracy on this. This one doesn't have Tracy. You probably shouldn't buy it. You know, he was saying all kinds of crazy stuff. So a couple months later, then we go to the Napa Valley Emerging Songwriter Contest. Dave wins that one. At some point, he wins the Sierra Songwriter Contest. We're 3-for-3 now, right? With no record. And people keep asking us, and he keeps handing them Snake Handling Man and saying the same thing, but Tracy's not on it. We gotta do this. So we decide that job one after we get home is to make this record.
She's a walking, talking, breathing new age wonder. Old time heathens don't know what to make of Mary Jane. Cause she ain't trying to be no swami. She ain't mad at dad and mommy. She don't curse.
Dave's got a little bit of stuff in his studio, and he decides that my place is more spacious, which is true because he was living in a tiny studio apartment and I had a two bedroom in Portland, Oregon. And my apartment was basically a shoebox. You know, you walk up the stairs, it's a second floor apartment, and just imagine a long shoebox of a room, half of which is carpeted, half is linoleum, but that's it. There's like no divider or anything. It's just a big space. We set up the equipment against the far wall, place the mics in the middle of the room, and one chair. And we started taking turns recording each other. You know, neither of us felt confident enough about playing at the same time, you know, the instrument and singing. So we did everything track by track, put the guitar down first, then do a vocal, or put the guitar down, then a mandolin, then whatever. And so it just went this way, painstakingly, slowly, you know, track by track by track in the middle of my living room / kitchen. You know, we went from engineering each other to engineering ourselves and just adding things for the other person to hear, and incrementally got built until all of a sudden it was done. We took our tracks over to our friend Mark Fretham at a place called Dr. Digital in Portland. Everything was on ADAT at the time, which is basically a VHS tape. Mark edited it and put it together for us, and we had ourselves our first record, made in my kitchen.
Normally at this point in the podcast, I would go through Dave Carter's amazing songs on When I Go track by track. But why do that myself when I have the woman who was there for every one of them on the line? We began with the title track I listened to 5 times in a row in my hotel room in Albuquerque.
Dave was perfectionist, but which is interesting to me because when I listen to the things now, I hear plenty of flaws. So it's curious to me, you know, what did we consider a flaw at that time and what were we willing to overlook? But obviously the recording of When I Go starts with the banjo, so we had to get that right. He'd sing the song, he'd stop himself, he would berate himself. This was a process. This, you know, recording was not easy for us, actually, now that you've got me thinking about it. It was in some ways, you know, a triumph and revelatory, but in some ways quite horrible, just because it was so important for him to get it right, to match the track he heard in his head, which he couldn't always perform. So the agonizing process of getting that lead vocal down.
Come, lonely hunter, chieftain and king, I will fly like the falcon when I go. Bear me, my brother, under your wing, I will strike, feel like lightning when I go.
After which, I recorded my vocal. Now, me matching Dave, that came pretty easily. We wanted to sound like one person, basically, whenever there was a harmony. That was our aesthetic. Some people go in for, you know, where the harmony vocal can sound like a separate entity, like you want to recognize that separate person. You know, if Mary Chapin Carpenter sings harmony on my song, I don't mind if you hear that it's her. You know what I mean? She can kind of do her thing. But in the case of us, we just wanted to follow each other again, hand in glove, you know, foot in shoe, tight, a nice tight fit. And that was something I could do.
I will bellow like the thunder drum, invoke the storm of war, a twisting pillar spun in dust and blood up from the prairie.
So the harmony vocal went on next, and then came the violin part. Now the lines that are in between the verses. Those are written. Dave wrote those. That was the idea that he had. But at the end, I was like, hey, what if, you know, on that, when you do that crazy banjo thing, what if the violin also takes off? What if it just has this lift off? You know, we really wanted to capture the idea of a spirit just, you know, in flight. We had to do it a number of times, but the part came to me pretty quickly. What I thought, you know, that twirling dervishy thing at the end would sound like, and we put it on there. And even though it does create a little bit of chaos with the banjo part, we loved it.
Spring spirit dancer, nimble and thin, I will leap like coyote when I go. Tireless entrancer, lend me your skin. I will run like the gray wolf when I go.
Also for Dave, you know, that is a song that he had written for his mother when she was dying with Alzheimer's disease, and he never got to sing it for her. But it was just important to him personally. You know, it had all this weight behind it. I mean, to this day, I feel like it should be included in poetry anthologies. It's just beautiful on the page. And then you add the music to it, and it's all the glory.
1 pound of flesh and a gallon of sweat, just your daily payment on the national debt. But all God's children got a right to be free. Mr. State Trooper, don't you tread on me.
Yeah, don't tread on me. Gosh, you know, I wonder about that song in today's context. Like, it's that, you know, Dave had sides. You know, I feel like his many personalities come out. Like, and that's sort of what I love about his writing, too, is that there's no side of him that he didn't express in song, you know? So even though it's hard to believe that Don't Tread on Me could come from the same guy as When I Go, comes from the same guy as Kate and the Ghost of Lost Love, but this is, you know, this, we contain multitudes, right? And so there they are. So you have Don't Tread on Me, which, what did he call it? A redneck national anthem is how he referred to that song.
Annie's lover was a medicine man, and he roamed the chokes and boulders. Hickory staddle in his big black hand, and a star upon his shoulder. He'd go down to the meadow at night. He would dance in the firefly light, and she would dream like a pagan queen when he'd hold her.
Now, Annie's Lover, that is an interesting song. So that was written for Al Grierson. Dave and Al became friends at the Kerrville Folk Festival, I believe, and began a corresponding with each other. They recognized the poet in one another. You know, they were both these kind of crusty poet, goddess-loving guys, you know, And so they really, they saw that in one another. They witnessed that for one another. They swapped poetry. They swapped thoughts about the goddess. You know, Al, I think, had a long distance relationship that he needed some help with. I'm really surprised he went to Dave, but there you go.
Zanny's lover was a wildcat's brother and a badger's mad companion. In his rainbow beads and his straw hat, he was the king of Mercy Canyon. He was the king of Mercy Canyon.
Dave just wanted to write a song for a guy who, you know, for this lover of women and lover of the goddess. And so Annie's Lover is what he came up with. Yeah.
St. Peter, when you call me, you can find me waiting here beneath this sad mimosa tree with a cord to drive through beer. For home is in the heartland, but the heartland cannot save you when the heart is gone. And home's moved on.
He did have a thing about Texas, and Grand Prairie is where his grandmother's house was. And across the street from his grandmother's house really was a drive-through beer joint. You know, and we actually went on a trip when we were in Texas, and he said, let's go see the house. And I remember it was on Dolworth Street, but I don't remember the number. And the only way we were able to locate it, because it had completely been, you know, overgrown with vines and bushes and everything, was by spotting the drive-through beer place across the street. It's like, wait, if that's there, then, and then we turned and there was the house. Yeah, I still have pictures from that day. That's a really precious memory.
Sweet Kate, open your gate. Here I stand in the wind. Threadbare snow in my hair. How I need you again.
Kate and the Ghost of Lost Love is an interesting song. It didn't start the way it ended. Now, this is one that did undergo a huge transformation, not in my time, but he had actually written this melody and this counterpart like when he was young, maybe in the 70s, late 70s or 80s. If I remember correctly, he said that he wrote this melody after house sitting for somebody in their trailer in the woods, where the only thing there was to listen to was The Marriage of Figaro. So whatever headspace that put him in made him come up with these intertwining melodies. Dave's early writing is very environmentally focused, almost activist writing, very concerned with the health and the well-being of the planet. And so this song was originally called The Bee Song and had a whole different, completely different lyrics. I don't know what made him change it. I don't know at what point everything switched. I suspect it was around the time that he started thinking about Nashville as a place where his songs might find a home, which of course was never going to happen because of the writer that Dave is. He's just not mainstream. But I think this is his idea of a mainstream, a potentially mainstream country love song. And who am I to say it's not? There's still time. You know, someone may take it and make it their own. I have no idea. But yeah, this song had an interesting, you know, an interesting trajectory to its current state.
Sweet Kate, Lancelot rode on a swayback mare. He won in a card game up north somewhere. He was bottom out lonesome. He was too tired to care, keeping one step ahead of the rain.
I think Lancelot is some of Dave's finest lyrics, and I think he felt that way too. Again, this is a song that we had done with the band with all kinds of crazy harmonies that just got whittled down to the two of us. An easy one to record, actually, because we knew it so well.
Singing your delay, I ain't no untarnished Galahad. Down from Arcadia, like a dream in your head. But gentle lady, lend me the true heart I never had, and I'll bring you roses and bread. And we'll fashion gold out of lead. With all the illusions we shed, Lancelot said.
The depths to which he mined his life for this material and then wove it into things like the Lancelot myth and these archetypes that he worked with. It's really stunning, you know, how he was able to make something cohesive from all of these threads. Dave grew up, you know, around a lot of characters, and I think a lot of them ended up in these songs.
And he's changed his name from Frank to Valentino. And he's growing out his sideburns, and he's wearing platform shoes, and he's driving on the midnight road from Medford down to Reno. And he thinks he's found a way to cure his working blues.
Either one person or kind of a combination of people is who Frank to Valentino is. I mean, it's not hard to imagine, you know, that dream of wanting to go somewhere and change your life, you know, and just be somebody new. I mean, and actually, this is a theme. I think it's a theme in Dave's songs. I think it comes up again and again, the transformation.
Lord, have mercy on the working stiff, pulling graveyards and double shifts, trying to hold his own beside the pretty and the bright, giving up the dream of his own backyard and juggling taxes and credit cards. Now he's rolling like a ghost train through the night.
Yeah, The River Where She Sleeps is one of the, that's one of the Kerrville songs. It's one of the song contest songs. And so our strategy with When I Go and The River Where She Sleeps, there are two songs with banjo, which other people weren't really using much. And then you have this, you know, poetic song, and then you have this, whoa, how many lyrics could you squeeze into one song, which is The River Where She Sleeps.
Now one dismayed December dawn, I wake to find my Mary's gone, and no one knows when she'll come back again. And all the silent temple bells, from Styx to Glen to Hazel Dell, are mourning all the nights that might have been.
Again, a mythology, a built mythology around a woman who he had the briefest of encounters with. You know, he told this story a number of times, a woman with dreadlocks and a big pack on her back. And he said he looked into her eyes and he just felt like he'd had a spiritual connection, you know, a spiritual experience. Like he knew her, he understood her, and he loved her. You know, and this was Dave Carter's heart. You know, he would find people like this who would just show him how open he was. And if you couple that encounter with our friend Arlene's challenge that you can't rhyme the word orange, Dave, then you get this song. So that's where River Where She Sleeps comes from.
When the sun refused to shine, well, she don't mind. She just laid this world behind. She got wheels in her smiles. She can coast along for miles. Me, I'm walking all alone, feeling soulful to the bone, till I stop and I hang my head and weep by the river where she sleeps.
Late night drive, AM radio. We're listening to the Fire and Brimstone Preachers, you know, which we sometimes listen to just to see. It was either that or like Dr. Laura, you know, or advice shows. Yeah, a late night preacher saying, throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline.
Tell him, throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline. somebody's drifting away.
You know, Dave had this strong evangelical background, and that just rung a bell in him, and he came home and wrote that song. I mean, again, with Lancelot, again, some of his most beautiful lyrics, and a song I think that's really overlooked in the span of all the other songs.
Tell him throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline, somebody's drifting. Hey,
I think if someone took an album like When I Go and studied it, you know, just the breadth of it, what has been called up from a single person, you know, all the images and the influences and the poetry and the silliness, you know, just to honor whatever you've got and to honor your own experience and to understand that where you've been and what you've seen and what you know is enough to write a song, you know, just stick to your truth, your images, your metaphors, and mine them as deeply as you can. And you can't help but produce something beautiful.
Since Dave Carter's death, Tracy Grammer has kept his songs and memory alive through the recording of his songs, the telling of their stories, and archiving their brief but powerful time together. She has also flourished into a brilliant songwriter herself, releasing solo albums and touring the country.
Well, I miss you like I love the sound, those blackbirds in the trees. I sit alone and wish that maybe one of you would come visit me. But no matter how much seed I hang or what prayer I call out, I cannot bring that burden from the field or make an angel come around.
In July, I was doing a 10-day tour out east and found myself with a free Sunday. I noticed that the Falcon Ridge Folk Festival was going on just an hour from where I had been Saturday night. Tracy Grammer was there, along with her musical partner Jim Henry, as well as a great lineup of other acts on the main stage. I said hello to Tracy and settled in for their set. It was a great mix of Tracy's songs, old and new, Dave Carter songs, and even her haunting cover of Tom Russell's Blue Wing. While she was playing Dave's song, The Mountain, this happened. I saw out of the corner of my eye a shadow emerge from the sky. Me and most of the large crowd gathered for the concert looked up as a huge hawk swooped over and then disappeared up and into the clouds. Now, if you know me, you know that I would most likely just consider that a happy coincidence. But when it comes to Dave Carter, all bets are off. No Root, No Fruit is hosted, produced, and written by me, Matt Watroba. I absolutely love doing this work, but it takes time. If you'd like to keep the podcast going, please consider heading over to norootnofruit.com to make a direct donation or to join the growing number of sustaining subscribers on my Patreon page. I'm also eager to hear your thoughts, ideas, and questions about the podcast, so feel free to drop me an email from that page as well. You can also just join our growing Facebook group. Thanks again for funding season 2 with a successful Kickstarter campaign, and I'll be back with more in a couple of weeks.